So most of what I'm going to talk about today is based on a paper that was just published recently, where we try to have a better feeling of what the new faint dwarf galaxies that were recently discovered around the Milky Way, M31, what these systems could be and what we really know about them, and how we need to change our way to derive their parameters, because they're so faint that they just contain a few stars and their properties are not necessarily properly sampled, and techniques used before don't necessarily work on these systems. And so, for instance, something that's usually said on these very faint galaxies with magnitudes from 0 to minus 8, roughly, is that they appear very distorted. And so here, there's a real galaxy, a map of a real galaxy that some people have argued is distorted. And the three others are just model of purely spheroidal systems, only sampled by about 300 stars, which is the number of stars that are in the SDSS for the real galaxy which appears here. So I'll just collect the money, you can all bet. I'll keep 35% of that, and I'll redistribute the money for those who are right.
How much do you keep?
35%.
Too much.
But 35% of zero.
Zero, I think. So the real one is actually this one, and you were right, actually. So that's the real faint galaxy, and some people have said, oh, it is S-shaped, and so it seems to be distorted, and it's probably undergoing some tidal interaction with the Milky Way, etc., etc. But if you were to take this one, or that one, you would have the same kind of expectations by just looking at the maps, whereas it's just you to the low number of stars that we have to really sample the properties of these systems. So just to get back a bit.
That was cool.
Wasn't it? You wanted to see it again?
It's a French thing, huh?
No, it's a Californian thing made in Cupertino by Apple. So around the Milky Way, the SDSS has been used to find 10, 12 new satellites that most of us believe are dwarf galaxies. We have them all there. A few of them have been discovered in some constellations. Overall, they have magnitudes from a few hundred solar luminosities, 1,000 solar luminosities, to up to 10,000, maybe 20, 30,000 solar luminosities, but these systems are extremely faint. The previous record holder was Draco at about minus 8.8. So some of them, you can start to see Kanizmatsky 1 at minus 8.6 probably shouldn't be called differently, shouldn't be put in a different kind of sample as Draco. It's about the same magnitude. It's just been discovered now because it's further out from the Milky Way than Draco. So it's basically unclear whether these systems are just the natural continuation of the brighter galaxies that we all knew about until a few years ago, or whether some of them are new things produced differently, or whether they're remnants of something bigger or brighter. We find similar things around Andromeda. So here, just to give you an example, that's Leo T. It's about the only few you can really see on the pictures. That's Leo T here, and you can see it because it's sitting at 400 and something kiloparsecs from the Milky Way. And that's Andromeda 20 with a magnitude of minus 6.5, just recently discovered. That's coming out of the telescope just 2 weeks ago. And these systems, you know, they really contain just a few stars. The sampling of the Milky Way satellite system, or the M31 satellite system, is highly incomplete because the SDSS only covers a quarter of the sky, and our surveys around M31 can cover roughly a third of the halo of M31. So a few years ago, life was simple. That's a summary plot of the Milky Way satellite system. This is the bottom. You have the size of the systems as their half-light radius, and on the left you have the magnitude of these systems. So the bright systems are at the top, the bottom, the faint systems are at the bottom. And before you have the globular clusters, which have a whole range of magnitudes, but are usually fainter than previously known dwarf galaxies. And on top of that, there was a definite gap between the two. The globular clusters have sizes of the order of a few parsecs, maybe at max 10, 20 parsecs, whereas dwarf galaxies had sizes of more than 100 parsec. Life was simple, and then it got ugly. These are the new discoveries from the SDSS, and so you can see that it goes fainter, and also it goes to much smaller sizes. So some of these here are probably just flukes in the catalogs. I wouldn't really believe most of them down there, but there hasn't been any.
Why don't you believe them?
Because they've been published in papers where they're looking for candidates, and they just publish a list of five things that could be systems. And I would wait to have some deeper data or some spectroscopic data to really believe them.
Is the overall S shape due to tidal distortion?
No, it's due to detection limits. So the systems that are here are systems that are big but very faint, so they're impossible to detect with the SDSS at the moment. Surveys like PanSTARRS will push this limit down by about magnitude, so down to this limit probably. But to get back to one of the questions which was mentioned, one of the things that was mentioned this morning, we're never going to be able to find the one galaxy with three stars because there's no way we, it's going to be way down there. So we have to do with what we...
Would be able to find it with Gaia?
If it really contains three stars, they're probably low-mass stars and they're probably very faint, so they won't be picked up by Gaia.
Pretty sure there should be a theoretical limit. If you extrapolate the global clusters down, this relation, so where you have these lowest points,
yeah.
I'm pretty sure there is a limit for you know, this system should evaporate within a certain amount of time. Because yeah. Evaporation is pretty efficient. If these guys see for 5 billion years, for example, so few stars, they should be evaporating. And so there may be a way, regardless of what they are, there may be a way to exclude such systems in operation.
Mm-hmm. But if they're in massive, yeah, exactly.
Because it's a stellar encounter. I mean, the stellar encounters can unwind the stars.
But the evaporation depends also. It's also very sensitive to the position with respect to the Milky Way. Or the orbit of the
orbit. It doesn't depend on the tidal force at all. It's just a binary interaction.
It actually does depend on the tidal field indirectly because
indirectly, yeah.
So maybe we will never find these systems because they don't exist. But for these that we, for which we have data, so the main answer, the main question is whether these systems are just fainter dwarf galaxies or whether they're disrupted things or whether they're completely different systems that we just didn't knew about before. And it still appears that they are dark matter dominated. Spectroscopic surveys conducted by myself or Josh Samenmala, Jiha, or and we mentioned that last week, show here you have the luminosity of the systems and here their mass to light ratio. So even under very simplistic assumptions of mass follows light, et cetera, that's very conservative. And they still have masses that fall roughly 10 to the 7 solar masses within their stellar radius. And for the new ones, they fall in this regime here, where it might go off the relation, but maybe this is just because we sample a smaller part of the dark matter halo. But overall, it's very difficult to make these systems just pure stellar systems without any dark matter.
We had some discussion this morning about top-heavy IMFs. Why couldn't there be bottom-heavy IMFs in some of these systems? And is there any way that you would ever be able to know
just decapitate.
Well, if you look at the have a lot of brown dwarfs, for example.
If you look at the elemental abundances, you see a scatter of these systems. But you do see some stars that have been enriched with an IMF that's the same as enriched the stars in the halo or famous enriched the stars in the bulge.
So the argument then is that if you have a body, bottom-heavy IMF, it can be too bottom-heavy.
Yeah, you can't fiddle things too much because there really are constraints from the elemental abundance. And at least for the more luminous ones, see Ursa Minor there. If you look at the existing faint stars in that now, you can get a handle on the other end of the IMF, the low mass thing. And that's the same in that as it is in globular clusters, as it is in the disks, as it is in the bulk.
The difficult bit is a bit in the middle, which we heard from Jennifer, which is the constraints, the intermediate mass. But really, I think, you know, there are constraints. The constraints are getting better as we're building up more and more data on the elements.
Are any of these reaching the point where they can't be self-enriched, where it must be metals coming from intergalactic?
Well, I think the whole issue of how these things form stars in the pictures.
But is there enough supernovae? There'd be enough supernovae. In, I mean, clearly the things that are down around a few hundred solar luminosities, you're beginning to run out of massive stars, aren't you? To make any.
Well, what happened to the stars?
You know? But then there are degenerate. We're seeing massive stars. It's the degeneracy, right? In other words, the metal return depends on the mass of the progenitor. There's more lower mass progenitors. So, I mean, suppose we just chop things at, you know, 10 solar masses. Is that enough? I mean,
no, you see a signature in the elemental abundance sense because different progenitor supernovae produce a different mix of the elements.
So, you have enough sensitivity to constrain that there has to be as many, you know, sixes, as many twos.
Let's say the error is also the nuclear synthetic yield.
Basically, it gets down to the question of what are the properties to try to understand whether they're dark matter dominated or whether they're not, or whether they're streams, or et cetera, et cetera. And as I was saying, these systems contain just an extremely low number of stars that, down to the SES's depth, is between 30 to 400 stars. And so you have to derive the properties of these systems from just the distribution of 30 or 300 stars.
What does 30 stars mean? 30 stars above a certain luminosity?
Yes, that in the SDSS doing a cut to remove obvious contaminants.
Right,
is common.
So typically, this is cut at
22.5 ng. So.
But for the ones that have 30 stars.
Because maybe a couple of magnitudes below the main sequence.
It depends on their distance. Sometimes
you
just
have.
For Segway 1, yeah, you get a 1 or 2 max under the main sequence turnoff. But you also have other systems with only 30 stars, and you see that they're quite far away at 150 kiloparsecs, and you see them because you see a very faint red giant branch, and on top of that, you see some blue horizontal branch that you can isolate quite easily.
There again, can you get any handle on how many stars they've lost just by looking at the luminosity function of stars in your sample of 30 and comparing that to a single-age population, say? Or
I haven't looked at that, but I would expect that if you just have 30 stars, you have no clue as to what the real luminosity function is. You need to go really faint and get the main sequence turnoff to have the number of stars that are in the main sequence turnoff to have a good statistic, a good handle on the luminosity function.
I mean, I'm sort of thinking of the first thing that if you imagine making million stars or something, you'd think you would sample the mass function.
Mm-hmm.
You'd get some nice continuous distribution of masses, and therefore you'd see, you know, a nice sequence with no gaps in it, and that the gaps in the sequence are some measure of what fraction of the population.
No, it's just pure Gaussian.
Yeah, exactly. I'll talk about that a bit later when I have the models. And as I was mentioning, there were some claims that some of these systems are distorted, and it's true that if you look at some maps, just because you have a few stars, you know these things obviously look distorted, but it might just be the contours that are distorted and not the intrinsically systems. So what we've been doing is actually try to rederive all the structural properties of these, well...
This seems incredible to me that, you know, people would make statements like this. So, I mean,
you're just arriving Mars or something?
Yeah, okay.
So the contours are, you know, you can even call those confidence contours. You know, the noise level.
Right, except
you can pull like one sigma, two sigma, three sigma. So
two things. First, they use conditional. So they say it might be distorted. It could be undergoing something. And second, what they do usually, most of the time, because you have so few stars, it requires some smoothing. And so when you start smoothing everything, you tend to mix up all your uncertainties everywhere.
I mean, this is done in X-ray maps all the time, you know, when you have like a number of photons like this, and what is plotted is one sigma, two sigma, you know, contours.
Yeah.
I think Nick is going to say how to do this right. Right?
Yeah, exactly. So what we've been doing is actually getting a homogeneous set of structural parameters for all the new systems using the SDSS. So on the left, for instance, you have Budas 1, which contains about 300 stars on top of the background. And on the right here, you have the best model that we derive. So I'll just get to how we derive the model in a minute. But what we are interested in is the centroid of the system, obviously. Its position angle with respect to the north-south axis. Its half-life radius, assuming an exponential model. And its ellipticity, which is the axis ratio of the 1 minus the axis ratio of the system. And also the background level, which can be related to the number of stars that we have in these systems. So just to do a bit of math for 2 seconds. So just to bash on previous work once again. And I'm among the people who have been doing that, so I can do it. So as I was saying, what people have been doing usually before is to smooth the maps because there isn't enough star to have any signal when trying to see the ISO contours of these systems. So people have been smoothing these maps. The problem is that when you smooth, you have to assume a pixel size, you have to assume smoothing kernel, and you have to assume the background threshold over which the pixels are assumed to represent something of the system and not of the background.
So that's a really key thing. So Andre, you gave this example of the X-ray maps where people can do this just very easily, but in these star maps, the background issue I think is a lot more of a problem than in the X-rays, where if you see one or two photons, you can actually say with very high likelihood that this is not background. I mean, the background is zero in a lot of those cases.
So what makes it hard to estimate background for these galaxies?
So you can do it. The thing is that you draw your contours, for instance, and whether you take the two all pixels which are higher than 2 sigma or all pixels that are higher than 3 sigma makes a difference because you at 2 sigma you include more pixel backgrounds in your estimate, and by definition the background is spherical. So when you try to derive your ellipticity, for instance, you add some sphericality in your system just by the pixels you choose to keep or not. So then you can cut and just say, I'm just going to take my 5 sigma, the pixels that are higher than the background, this 5 sigma level.
I don't understand why they need to pixelize to keep your ellipticity. In fact, you want to retain as much information as possible, so you don't want to pin it all.
Right, so this is what I've been doing with maximum likelihood.
Did you mention that not all those dots are very likely to be in the galaxy?
You can see the galaxy here.
Right, I know, but there's color information in there.
Yeah, so here I've already cut out all obvious contaminants by doing a column magnitude selection. Because if you look at the column magnitude diagram, you see the tracks that the star follow. So just removing things that are obviously.
But are you still getting additional information from the color of the things in the name? Color magnitude of things in the name, because the distribution's peaked.
Yeah, I haven't used that. Yeah, I guess I could replace all the. Give a probability of each star according to that color magnitude diagram position of being a real member or not. That could be added.
And what are the other things? Are they foreground?
Yeah, foreground or background stars, mainly they're disk stars.
So what about proper motions for those?
I wouldn't believe proper motion for that. You might be able to remove a few very bright stars, but for most of them, there's just no catalog to.
I think this color, they're halo stars anyway. You're writing about them. These are fairly blue things, aren't they?
Yeah.
So a lot of it's the halos, and you get it from the proposition.
So basically, you could play a bit more and remove an extra maybe 10 or 20%. I'm not sure it's worth it, to be honest, but it could be checked.
And what are the target stars? Are they giants or?
For this one, it's giants and horizontal branch and a bit of the subgiant.
Actually, could you show us the color magnitude diagram? The isochrones into whatever you want to call it.
I could, if you give me a minute.
Just to show how you isolate the stars. Presumably after he's taken off the lids, all you're left is with that uncertainty. So you're saying that you do it as a function of distance and you can get rid of one?
I just think if a lot of them are giants, and red giants, then you're going to have a universe or something.
Okay.
of sulfur.
So that's from another paper, but basically this is the SDSS data for Butes 1, which was the system that I was showing just before. The Kalman-Itu diagram is here. And so the various dots are the targets that we followed spectroscopically. Targets that we followed spectroscopically that are members and non-members. So these stars happen to be members of the galaxy. So basically you see down there that there's the bottom part of the subgiant branch, then you have the red giant branch, which just contains a few stars. And then you have the horizontal branch here, which is really how these systems were, some of these systems were detected, because halo contamination is roughly here, and you have almost no stars as blue as that. So when you start finding 7 or 10 of them, it's quite obvious that these are, that there's an overdensity of stars here. So what I do for the structural parameter analysis is just cut everything which is not, just extract stars which are around the horizontal branch, the red giant branch, and then down there the subgiant or the main sequence turn off, depending on the depth of the system.
Anyway, in that diagram, what's, you know, in your fit, this one right here, how many of those stars are galaxy and how many aren't?
How many of those stars are?
What's the fraction of all the dots there that are galaxy?
It's a few tens of percent, 20-40% for this system. But in some of the cases, you have this is one of the most populated systems in the SDSS with 300 stars. When you have just 30 stars, sometimes you see, most of the time you do see an overdensity because it can be further away, so it's just going to be very clustered on the sky. But we still have only 30 stars out of 600 stars extracted from this region of the SDSS. So when doing some smoothing, there are some assumptions on how the smoothing is done. Other ways to get rid of some of the parameters was to assume that there's no ellipticity in these systems and then just compute the profile, the radial profile from that, and then assume some radial profile, whether exponential or Plummer or King or whatever. With the maximum likelihood, the only thing that has to be assumed is the model. And how it works very quickly is that one tries to maximize this function, the likelihood function, which is a product of the model taken on the data points for a set of parameters. So these are the parameters of the model that one tries to estimate. This is the model, so the exponential profile. And so then the only thing is to express the model as a function of only these parameters and the position of the stars that we get from the SDSS. So it's a bit of a long equation, but in the end, you have all the parameters which are expressed here, and that one tries to estimate, and things that are related to just the position of the stars in the SDSS. And so when we have that, then the only thing to do is just to go through all the parameters and try to find the set of parameters of all these parameters that maximizes the function. So when you do that for Butes, for instance, you get the 6 parameters are estimated. The dots here are the best models. And the other nice thing with maximum likelihood is that you can use the point where the likelihood drops by a given factor to estimate the uncertainties right away. So not only do we have the best model, but we have the uncertainties. And the uncertainties include the covariance between the various parameters. So for instance, if you look at the ellipticity against the half-light radius or against the background, these are the 3 parameters which have some covariance. You still have a handle on how badly deriving the ellipticity impacts on the derivation of the half-light radius, for instance.
And it's a practical matter how you probe in this six-dimensional space.
MCMC or?
Yeah,
no, just brute.
Precession?
No, error? I just. Wait. How do you
probe a six-dimensional space? Just a grid?
Yeah, just a grid. That is refined iteratively to by hand, basically. No, just by hand. It takes sort of, it takes 10 minutes to probe the parameter space.
And so each, these are full marginals though, not computed by the session matrix.
No, they're full marginal. And so the error bars in cases like Buddhas with 300 stars are pretty small. On the electricity, for instance, so these are drops of the maximum likelihood by 50, 90, or 95%, so they can't be used directly to estimate the uncertainties. But the electricity is measured down to 0.05 half-life radii. In this case, it's about 12 plus or minus 1 or something like that. So they're very, very good estimates of the parameters. And even going down to systems with only 30 stars, this is Leo 4, there's still some reasonably well-behaved contours. This one appears ugly, but it's because the system, here you can see the elasticity, the system is almost spherical, circular at least. So the PA, which is the angle of the major axis, has no meaning at all, which is why it's going all over the place. But apart from that, most of the other parameters are well-defined, the background level, the half-life radius, which is 2.5 plus or minus 0.5 or something like that. And so we do that for all our systems, all the systems that were discovered in the SDSS. And on this plot, I show the comparison between the data binned with the best electricity, PA, and centroid compared with the best model that we derived. So basically just the exponential with the half-life radius that we derived. And in most cases, the comparison between the model and the data are pretty good. That's Buddhist one over there. Buddhist 2, 40 or 50 stars works great. Sivan 1, 500 stars look pretty good, et cetera, et cetera. These are two objects that I wouldn't really believe in before having deeper data. We talked about Segway 1 the other day. Once again, the parameter estimates seems to give us a comparison of data.
There are more stars in Woman 1 than Leo 4?
Yeah, there's 100 stars in Woman 1.
Okay.
And Leo 4 has only 30. So now that we have models, we can try to play a few games with them. The first thing is how to properly estimate the magnitude of these systems. For brighter systems, it was easy because the Kalamanchu diagram was properly sampled. And there were maybe 1,000, 2,000, 10,000 stars along the red giant branch. So at each given position of the luminosity function, there were enough stars to properly sample it. Whereas for these systems, there are just a few stars along the red giant branch, or maybe no stars along the red giant branch. And so it gets very difficult to estimate the absolute magnitude of a system, because depending on where one red giant branch star is going to be along the red giant branch itself, it's going to have a huge impact on the overall luminosity that we measure for the system. So here you have the Kalamanchu diagram of Woman 1, which is estimated at about 1,000 star luminosities. You see down there the main sequence turnoff and then the red giant branch, which completely disappears in the data. So maybe these two stars seem to be spectroscopically confirmed as members, but the problem is that the tip of the system is over there. So depending whether...
Just repeat that a second.
The tip of the red giant branch
is up
there.
Uh-huh.
So basically, there could be red giant branch stars all over up to there. And the fact that there might be just one just under the tip will double the luminosity that we estimate for the system.
Well, why don't you measure the time average on this?
Because you don't know...
Yeah, you do. You have some idea of what how long things spend on the red giant branch and looking at the systems. I mean, this is just as stochastically done as the shape.
Yes, exactly. So what we actually do is use the, so from the model that we have is the number of stars in each of these systems. And so what we do is we actually reproduce Kalamanchu diagrams of something like Wilman 1 with the parameters that we estimate. And then we get a magnitude that's the magnitude for one realization. When then we do Monte Carlo, it's quite similar to what you do.
But
then
we should call it the time average luminosity.
But how do you measure the time average luminosity?
That's just what you're doing. You have all these things on it. I mean, that's what you are deriving as a time average luminosity, and that's what should be quoted to compare these different systems with each other. I mean, their luminosity today is of absolutely no interest.
Right, but I agree with that.
Yeah, so
agree with that.
This other thing is where it should be called.
And then it would make much clearer sense to people what people are talking about rather than realization.
Well, presumably it depends a little bit how, I don't know what the mass gaps are between the stars, but it's also a matter of did you happen to have 10 stars in the mass range where they'd now be that evolved, or 8, right, which is a separate form of, I mean, in other words, you can imagine two systems that will always have different luminosities, even though they're
no,
the same.
No, they total a lot of the giant branch.
Yeah. So, Andy, have you tried this procedure?
So what we do is very similar, actually. So we have we use the number of stars that we derive from the model, and that doesn't change. The number of stars in the galaxy, if it doesn't evaporate, remains the same all over throughout its history if it's not tidally distorted or if it's not evaporating. So from there, we assume the stellar population model fits on the same column entry diagram. We end up with one CMD from which we get one magnitude or one mass, and then we do that 1,000 times. And so we end up with a distribution of magnitudes of the system as it could be observed today, which is very similar to what you do.
But you're making a lot of assumptions when you do that. That's why I see where Andy's going, but right, in principle, you'd have to make a prior assumption about, you know, what the star formation history is, and age of the different populations are. You have to marginalize over all of that. And it's not obvious. You can't just make, start making another assumption.
Those things that, you know, we have these small systems, all those uncertainties are very small compared to a stochastic uncertainty of just having one RGB star.
That's why I was asking if you tried it. It's not obvious to me that they are.
They are. Okay. So the good thing is that all these systems are old and metal poor. So if you change their age by, you know, 2 giga years or something like that, the impact is really marginal. It's like you change the luminosity, the mean luminosity by 5% or something like that. So each histogram here represents one of the systems that I've been talking about before. And the spread in the histogram is actually the intrinsic scatter that comes from the Poisson sampling of the column entry diagram. So in each case, here you have presented the dot is the mean value, the median value, and the horizontal error bar is actually the spread, the one sigma spread for these systems. So if you take something like Draco, there are so many stars in Draco that whatever you do, you always sample the column entry diagram properly. So you always end up with the same value. And as you go down, it's also a question of how far these systems are, because you either sample just the red giant branch or the main sequence turnoff, et cetera. But basically one goes fainter, what happens is that each different realization can have a huge spread around the mean. So in a system like Segway 1 has a spread coming from just the sampling of the column entry diagram that is about one magnitude. So it's measured at minus 1.5, but it's actually minus 1.5 plus or minus 1. And this plus or minus 1 cannot be made any smaller by just going deeper. It comes from the fact that there are We don't really.
It's also of no physical interest. So in measuring the mean, you're done. I mean, this variation is only of interest because the very faint ones you wouldn't find or something.
That they're not all at the far right end of their the dots are not all at the far right end of their lines, because that would imply we're missing a whole bunch of them because they didn't happen to have the brightest
recognized. Right. I agree it's of interest for selection, but I mean, in terms of reporting...
So the one value you want is this one.
Yeah.
But then you also see that if you compare sigma 1...
Where's the dot in the middle?
Is that the it's median?
Oh, I'm sorry, it's on the median. So you don't... What is the actual measured value for this?
That would be assuming.
But you don't have a measured value.
I need the measured value.
No.
That is.
Measured value, you know, you add up all the light from the stars and can compare it to what the mean is from...
Yeah, but if you do that, then you have to correct from the background, and you have no idea whether this star that you pick and add to the total flux of the system is a real star or not.
So you need complete population.
No, that's not true. You have
it is.
Sampling, which you know, models these stars as having some probability of being in the distribution of being in the galaxy. You can extract from that same process what the light is.
Okay, if you do that.
If you have a background, you can do it.
Yeah. Okay.
If you have a background model. In fact, you might argue better off with a background model and not subtract.
And then Jennifer's question is very important, is whether all these, you know, whether all the observed luminosities are off to the right of the true luminosities. values, and then
right.
reflect the problem's finding.
Okay.
I guess, at least for these, it's not obvious you would select things that way, because you don't, selection's not really based on the brightest things, right? I mean, you're finding these things because you're finding stuff extending well down.
Yeah, because you find a horizontal branch.
So you'd hope that it might be representative.
So
but definitely if you go to finer magnitudes.
But in surface brightness, I mean, you can, so you're populating the color magnitude argument, but you're also populating the available stellar distribution as well. And so it sounds, there's a surface brightness selection effect as well, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It could be that you're sampling, you know, also the brightest ones in this distribution, but the things that are also the most centrally concentrated as well.
Yes, definitely. So there's been a couple of papers, one by Sergei Koplasov at the MPIA, who should be there, but is not there, I think. And one by Shane Walsh in Australia, looking at that. So putting fake systems in the SDSS and trying to recover them and have a sense of the completeness of the detection algorithms and so on. And then trying to inverse that to get a handle of how many cell lines should be around us, et cetera, et cetera. So there's been quite some work on that over the last couple of years, and I think it's just going to go, more and more people are going to do that. If one switches to mass, it's actually better, obviously, because there's along its evolution, a star has a smaller mass variation than a luminosity variation. But there's still quite some spread for some of these systems.
But isn't that all just made up because you don't actually know what the mass function is? Then
yes, it is. It's completely made up. So you have to assume an initial mass function.
He says, look, comma krupa.
I agree. I mean, so the masses are better because these histograms are narrower, but you still have to assume some IMF, and whether you take Salpeter or Krupa, you end up with a factor of whatever it is, 3 between the two.
The width of spread is presumably no different. So the width of the bar.
Yeah, so the width is not going to change, and the respective position of them is not going to change.
Coming back to Brent's question, if you assume that there could be more stars just because you have a cut in super brightness, you know, and due to the background population, but this, in principle, you go be farther than the half-life radius, right? So in principle, that correction cannot be very large, I would guess. I mean, you go some decades in the surface brightness. You were showing some profiles before.
Wait, you were talking about the central surface brightness or the surface brightness in the outer parts that you don't pick up?
I was just saying that, so each one of these galaxies is a realization of some random points,
right,
in the color magnitude diagram, but also you're selecting out some available orbits in the distribution of the stellar density distribution of these systems, right? And so,
but
systems that because there's a surface brightness limit effect, you're probably more likely to find galaxies where you've selected stars that happen to be closer to the center than, you know, some system where you have.
No. So what I do is that I extract a whole degree of the SDSS, and so that's 6, 10, 20 times the half-life radius. So if these stars are there, even the outer stars, they're there, and they're going to be used in the maximum likelihood fit.
And it's sort of, I think it's sort of like a match filter, right, in some sense, because now that you know where the color magnitude diagram is, you can go over that huge area and
select it out,
so then you're not at, so I don't think that surface brightness effect is entering in terms of picking out the more centrally concentrated stars relative, because you've got this chart.
Okay.
Or not chart, but you've got filter.
So the star is going to be in the sample, and it's going to be used by the fit.
Okay.
Whether it has a lot of weight or not is a different issue, because, as you say, there's a lot of background stars, but this star is there.
What's the width of the giant branch if you really have a single-age population? Is it just your photometric errors, or is there intrinsic scatter from star to star?
You can't tell from the SDSS.
But I mean, can you tell?
And
is there enough, I mean, if you form, like in a globular cluster, is there enough star-to-star scatter in metallicity to see that difference? Or?
In globular cluster?
In globular clusters,
it's beautiful.
It's like a
razor. So in a sense, you should be able to believe.
So we actually compared Willman 1. We got deeper data on Willman 1, and the main sequence turnoff is actually quite broad down there, and we compared that with Gobla cluster. I mean, just by eye, you look at the Gobla cluster, it's like a line. Well, you look at Willman 1, it's much broader.
Just going back to Rosie's, you know, she keeps telling us about the metallicity spread and distribution of these things, and so we know it's that's got to be thick. That can't just be the globular kind of razor. Okay, Rosie's reneging on her previous comments.
No, I don't think I made a comment about Willman 1.
Because I thought with some of these things at very low metallicities, there's also star to star.
Yeah, but the data we have most on is Blue.
But it's
not
enough.
We have some
SegWi
data, so there's SegWi 1, so there's
Marlowe,
and there's a spread,
Yeah, if Marlowe was in the dwarfs, but I was thinking also saying a globular cluster, that there's star to star.
Not anything but the light elements, that's generally not enough to tell
which one. Okay. You see these HST Fibonacci diagrams?
It's really
beautiful.
With the exception of the Vega Sand and maybe.
Right.
So moving on to another thing one can do with the models is actually looking for signs of distortion. That's what I was starting with. Buddhas is on the left, and these are two realizations of Buddhas.
Look for them. There's plenty.
Excuse me. So what I've been doing is binning the data and looking at computing this function, which compares the scatter that's in the data with respect to the that's the value of one pixel compared to the value of this particular pixel in the model, and then removing the Poisson scatter just because we don't have a lot of stars to in each of these pixels, and normalizing here. And so then looking at the distribution of this this function for 1,000 realization. So doing a lot of realization is going to change this part here because there's the Poisson, the number of stars is derived from the Poisson law.
So you're finding an ellipticity, but now you're looking at whether or not it's symmetric. Is that what you're...
Basically. In another way to put it is that I look at the model as a good representation of the data. Some extent. And so looking at the distribution of these parameters that I get for 1,000 realizations, so 1,000 different models, so I get these histograms for different pixel grids. And so all the points on the left mean that there's less scatter in this particular, that there's less scatter than the typical Poisson realization, which is where it would sit on zero because these two terms would cancel. And if I have a histogram which is mainly on the right side here, it means that there's, on average, more scatter than a typical Poisson realization. And so in 12 out of 14 galaxies or systems, we end up with something like that where there's no significant difference from zero at more than...
What scatter and what? Is more scatter...
Pixel counts.
Or distort. If you don't want the scatter, the distortion. There's less distortion. It's scatter in the number of stars per pixel compared to what you expect from just Poisson sampling.
Why, that gets back to Andrew's question. Why do you do pixels?
Why would you do otherwise? How would you do it otherwise?
Just preserve all the information by
pixelize, you lose information.
Right, but how do you compare? How do you look for signs of distortion in a? How would you look in?
You've got discrete set of points, right? You don't have continuous. I mean, by trying to make it continuous by pixelization, you lose information.
So pixelization is good when you have so much information and you have arbitrarily horrible things that could be going on, and you're looking for, the man in the moon or something like that. But if you actually have like 30 stars or 50 stars or something, you have to go with forward modeling. You have certain, different types of distortions that you're testing and find out whether they're compatible with the data or not.
Yes,
thing you could do, which bridges the gap, right, is you could think of doing a kind of wavelet transform or something and just saying how much power is there in this distortion mode and this mode and so on, which is equivalent to pixelizing. So at least in rectangular grids.
Because otherwise you have to model the distortion, and I have no, how do you model some random distortion that you don't have any clue as to how it appears on the scale?
You cannot fool statistics. I mean, if you pixelize and lose information, you're not going to get anything more than if you use all the data point on pixelized points.
Right, but then you have to compare it with a model of the distortion.
Right, no,
I'm not. I'm comparing with the case where there's no distortion. If there's no distortion, I know exactly how many stars I should have in each of my pixel. I have the best model.
Why can't you do it with discrete stars without pixelization? I mean, that's the same thing. I mean, you have a model which is not distorted, and you compare, you know, it's consistent with the data. How consistent is it?
Can I take a step back? So we'll come back to this Andre's point. So what is it you're really trying to do here? I kind of miss it. Is this a goodness of fit test effectively? When you say distortion, I'm not exactly, I mean, distortion from the model, I don't really get it.
I'm trying to see if there's some, if the sampling can be explained differently from just Poisson.
Which is another way of saying that your models aren't fit.
Yes, there's some small number of stars, and is it consistent with just the random sampling you would get if you just had a spherical distribution of stars?
So if I'm screwing up everything because I'm not taking the proper profile, then I'm going to have some deviation from zero here. But then if you get back to one of the plots that I showed at the beginning, the fit on the data look pretty good. Which is not to say that it works 100%, but there's no reason to assume that the exponential profile is not a good.
But you just asked, you know, basically, is there electrical or something like that?
Was that Andy speaking?
Yeah, you just ask if it's electrical, you know, just as a.
But we know it's electrical.
Equals two mode or something, okay, so then whatever. You know, then we can ask about, you know, N equals four mode.
Yes, yeah, so yeah, that's equivalent. If you just do it in rectangular coordinates, it's equivalent to pixelizing it, right? Yeah, it is. I mean, if you divide the thing up into four pixels, that's equivalent to measuring a quadrant.
The ellipticity was determined. You feed an elliptical model to an unpixelized set of points. Mm-hmm. You can come up with any other model. You have ellipticity plus higher moment imposed on it. Again, feed to the same set of points, and you compare the chi-square. You know, is the model much better fit to the data or not? If it's not, then there is no requirement for distortion, for example. Right? There's no need to pixelize anything. I mean, you can only lose information in this case with pixelizing.
It's just
you still ultimately need to compare two models to say one's a better fit than the other. How do you construct the other model? This is looking for distortions where you don't know what the distortion is.
The models are completely arbitrary, just like elliptical models are completely arbitrary because you don't know what the actual system is like, right? So, mm-hmm. You know, it's, you assume it could be described by ellipsoid, so you fit an ellipsoid. You can assume whatever you want. You can assume that it's described by, you know, a donut shape and try to fit it. Mm-hmm. You'll see that it's not going to fit, right? And then you know that's not the model, but you can construct whatever model you want because you don't know out there.
But what is the model of a distortion from tidal interaction or?
You have to go to Jorge. Jorge produces at various parts in the orbit. He produces, you know, ellipsoid. Well, he has million of particles. So the pixelization is not an issue. He tells you what the model should be, and then you try to fit it at different parts of the orbit. That would be physically motivated. But the way, you know, if you're just trying to ask arbitrary question, oh, is it distorted or not, you can come up with any model of distortion and try to fit it to the data.
Well,
yes.
That is an approach, actually, that's well defined in statistical probabilistic practice, which is that you basically do a Bayes ratio in a space which is much larger than the one you fitted and say, should I reject my model in a much smaller parameter space given this space of entire models? People do that.
But this is what he's doing. It's just the basis functions he's choosing involve pixels because that's convenient. Right? Mm-hmm. If you did it with modes or if you did it with some analytic shape to your distortion, it would be exactly the same thing. You'd be averaging over where the stars are and seeing how well they fit something. You can just think of this as exactly the same thing, where the shape of the distortion is just more stars in this pixel, less in this. There's no difference.
I agree, but what I don't understand, why do you choose to lose information? when you have just so, you know,
well,
so few stars.
So my guess would be you're looking for two things. You're looking for tidal distortion where you don't know which direction it's going in. So it's a fairly complicated shape, and you need a couple of parameters to describe it if you don't know which direction it's going in. So it's not a good thing to model with low order modes. And possibly also substructure that you want to see, you know, do you have a foreground lump of stars sitting in one position randomly superposed on this thing, both of which are seen in higher surface brightness dwarf galaxies.
Right, but you know, the thing is that in this pixelization thing, you're not giving weight to the model. You have all this crap all over the place that's, you know, mostly, you know, adding to chi-square from, you know, just pure background.
No, so I remove the pixels where the background is. I can't remember if it's at least higher than what I expect for the model or twice higher than what I expect for the model. So the pixels that contain basically just background, I remove them so that I'm not tied to star galaxy separation or whatever.
Okay. Anyway, as one of the most severe enemies of pixelization, I'd say we allow you to continue.
Thank you. I'm not saying it's the best thing. It's just the first.
These guys' point is that it's an inefficient statistic.
I would agree with that. I'm just saying that it's the first try at that, and basically the answer using that, which might be a very crude way of doing it, and maybe there's another way to do it and get a better handle on how these things are distorted. But doing that, there's actually no evidence of more than a 1 or 2 sigma deviation from the best model for two of the systems. It just so happens that these two systems are actually interesting because there's a clump of young stars in this one, and this one has been assumed to be disrupting. So, but it's still just 1 or 2 sigma detection. So basically, just looking at these, this is what Andrei was saying at the beginning. If you just look at these things, you have no reason to assume that they're distorted just because they look fancy or whatever.
Did you, with Ursa Major 2, did you look at all, there's deeper data on that from Subaru?
It's actually not, so this is just using the SDSS. Okay. I don't have access to the other data. We also have our own data on that, but I haven't tried it yet.
I should send you other public data that's deeper.
Okay. And then to conclude on the last part, one of the surprises when doing that is actually that we realize that there's a trend of ellipticity with luminosity of these systems. And as you go fainter, these systems become more elliptical. So here you have the distribution of luminosity down there with the faint systems on the right. And you have the ellipticity as 1 minus the axis ratio on the y-axis. All the globular clusters are these circles down there, so they're basically spherical, circular. Here you have the old systems down here, with the exception of Ursa Minor, which is quite elliptical. They're all with ellipticities of about 0.3, whereas going to the fainter systems, there's a lot of scatter because there are bigger error bars, but you also have a few systems with small error bars that are extremely elliptical.
Now, if you went to even brighter galaxies, dwarf ellipticals. Do they just go all over the place, or I'm just wondering if there's a, you make a statement there that faint galaxies appear flatter than bright galaxies, and I'm wondering if you went to brighter galaxies, if that would still be true.
I don't know what the ellipticity of ellipticals.
Faint galaxies appear. What was this? What did you say?
Whether the brighter ellipticals are actually at 0.3 or.
The definition of bright is.
But these are galaxies for different class. I mean, these are.
Okay, so. We've seen odd agreement between where certain galaxies types lie in certain connections. I was just curious.
So this is the Milky Way satellite system.
Is it just applied to the dwarf version of Milky Way, if it were?
There are a few cases. Yeah, Rosie?
I was going to say, have you plotted that versus the present galaxy
centric system? Yes, they're still the same kind of relation as. So those that are closer tend to be a bit more elliptical, but the problem is that it's highly incomplete as you go to further out. So to give you an idea of the distance, Ursa Minor is 80 kiloparsecs, 70 kiloparsecs.
It's the only distant one that's flattened,
right? Ursa Major is 100 kiloparsecs. Hercules is 130 kiloparsecs. C-Vent 2 is 160 kiloparsecs.
But
But most interesting would be the very center, right? Not the current.
Yeah,
center.
But we don't.
But that you don't know.
That is, that's why.
But you may not get a very,
yes,
very nice correlation with the current position.
That's also a question for you. So.
Okay. What worries me here is that how do you, I mean, if you measure the electricity, say at half, if you take only the stars that are located within half, the half-life radius, or one, the half-life radius,
I'm
or two.
I'm taking all the stars that are in the
I agree, but if you do what I'm saying, would you observe a different electricity? In other words, it might be that the electricity that you measure is dominated by the crack, that you, you know, by this.
Hey, let me spend maximum light. And you're showing most of them are always a good fit, so at least give them all your data then.
But if there is a variation with radius, what does it mean? I mean, is it because well, my fear is it's going to be dominated by the least, you know, by those points that are the most dubious.
But this is kind of odd then that you would get, do you think that would make the things rounder?
Yeah.
So
there's somebody down there, it's, you know, it's beautiful, it's maximum likelihood, it has no biases.
That's not true. Maximum light is fine.
Can I ask you my question real quick? Which is, what is the average? Suppose, well, if you took your model and decided a certain number of particles were stars, I'm thinking you would measure some average ellipticity because it would tend to be lined up on the orbit, and therefore you tend to see it in the plane of the sky. So that compared to, say, compared to dwarf galaxies around M31, for instance, you'd expect the Milky Way ones to be more elliptical. Does that sound right? Because they tend to be lined up. Their major axis would tend to be lined up along, or, you know, across their orbit or along their orbit.
I think not on radial orbits.
So the major axis, if it's tidally distorted, the major axis is supposed to point towards the galactic center.
But that's only close to the Paris.
Yeah, only close to Paris orbit and for circular orbits. Otherwise,
it's going to be close to the Paris center. They align and then they get some kind of torque.
Okay, so there's so you wouldn't expect any.
And another thing is that
another thing is that
I was showing yesterday that the crossing times, for example, you take Ursa Minor or you know one of these small things, and the crossing time that you measure there or you estimate there is 10 or 20, maybe 30 mega years. That's a very small fraction of the orbits of the orbital period. So if for some reason you know you're trying here to correlate the position with the galactocentric radius with the electricity and all that, trying suggesting that that might have a tidal origin, and it's extremely
it might also not have a tidal origin. I mean, you could just have an intrinsically elliptical thing, and then I'm just wondering with those torques.
Well, it's actually the problem I mentioned this the other day. I'm still mulling over. It's really hard to have an intrinsically elliptical thing. These mass to light ratios.
The halos are spherical at these masses. They're not
triaxial enough to produce. Remember, if these
mass
to light ratios are 1,000 or 500 or 100 even, you're totally dominated by the halo potential with the number, with the stellar masses that you have. So you only can respond to what the what the halo is doing, and they're not that elliptical.
But one thing is also true.
At least in the Atlantis, it could be crap, and then you have whatever will flow.
Are they not that elliptical?
For big guys, they are, but for the small ones.
But one thing is also true is that Aquarius, you have a mass resolution of 10 to the 3. In other words, for those systems, you have maybe, you know.
Yeah.
Even in Aquarius simulation, for those, you have like 10,000.
So Andre knows the answer to this, and he's just sitting here suppressing it.
What's the answer?
There's a very significant trend of triaxiality with mass. In the sense that the lower mass things are more spherical.
But for which?
there's all kinds of trends. There's also within each halo, there's a trend to be more elliptical near the center.
How much elliptical? I mean, how is the extrapolation? If you extrapolate to this massive, what would you predict?
I don't remember the exact numbers, but you know, something like 0.8 would be highly unlikely. The paper that measured this specifically for subhalos roughly in this mass range is Kulin et al. A year ago, 2007. So,
but it doesn't really work because. So I thought about that because some of the systems, or the new systems, are smaller. Then they could probe the smaller region of the dark matter halo and then end up being more elliptical because this is the part of the system which is more elliptical. The problem is that Ursa Major and Hercules have sizes which is typically the size of these systems down there, so there's no reason why the barons are sampling the same part of the dark matter halo, basically, for these systems compared to the bigger systems.
I agree. I'm just saying that you know, there's also dependencies on Bell-Lock eccentric radius and so on. Mm-hmm. I agree with you that this is very very triaxial. But on the other hand, it's not just dynamic halo triaxiality. It's you have to take sort of extreme example and say, well, suppose you know I can have halos of this triaxiality, and what sort of the maximum ellipticity for the stellar distribution that can be supported in this triaxial. This is discussion kind of coffee a week ago, and I don't know the actual number. Maybe it can be quite difficult.
Mm. Wasn't it the homework for Martin?
That's a hard calculation. The other thing I really need to have is a really good model for what the subhalo distribution really is, because you know.
So that exists. So that prediction for the halo, you can.
We needed it to small. You know, we need small ones of small scales. Yeah. My recollection of the Gao et al. Papers that getting a B over A smaller than 80% was very hard. I mean, I think that I didn't remember that they were getting 4 to 5, but not 2 to 1.
There's a big scatter around the mean, but the prediction specifically for subhalos in this mass range at the radii where we see the stars, they exist.
But Martin, there is something I don't understand. If you have now, even in a round halo, you can have a gas, falling in a prominent disk and, like a thick disk of stars. You say that if the halo is spherical, that wouldn't support anything elliptical inside?
All you have is, at these mass light ranges, all you have is the potential of the halo, the dwarf's halo. And so you have to support an ellipticity in the dwarf's halo. And so it's possible, for example, that if it's elliptical enough and you have a cold stream, you formed stars in this one cold stream, and it was sort of formed, moving around like this. It'll stay there. That's possible, but
It could be a thick disk of stars, right?
It also could be a disk. A disk is one way to do it, but that's why I was pressing the other day about whether or not there's a shear, right? You're seeing the disk, and some of it, but there appears to be no shear.
There's no obvious sign of rotation for these systems, but I guess it's also because we don't have the data to look for that at the moment. I'm a bit worried that with velocity dispersions of 5 km/s, and then you have to still correct from some rotation, you end up with velocity dispersion of 0 km/s.
Because you're sitting at the bottom of rotation curve, so rotation velocities are very small. Then of course you can question.
But then it wouldn't support.
Yeah, it wouldn't support the soon be
this. It's a bit odd. I mean, who knows how it will resolve? But it struck me the other day, and still strikes me.
You can figure out whether there's enough rotation to support the disk from the data. So if you have 5 km/s, you measure it to 2 km/s, I think that's the individual measurements.
Yeah, it goes down to 2.
And it's straightforward to tell whether one side is going towards you and the other side is going away.
I mean, that doesn't mean that it wasn't ever a disk.
I know, but if it's no longer a disk, then it's catching up.
Could have formed it.
I actually tell you what I think.
What do you think?
So just to take the example of.
Well, this is one of the winners.
Yeah, so that's one of the winners. That's Hercules. So we measure from the SDSS data an ellipticity of 0.65, and that's actually LBT data going down to 3 magnitudes below the main sequence turnoff, and we measure 0.68. So it's really it's not an artifact of the maximum likelihood or whatever.
But if you do the maximum likelihood, what's the error distribution in your original measurement?
So it's 0.65 plus or minus 0.05. Well, so it works.
Don't you think from this figure, I know that it's dangerous to visually deduce anything, but can you check how much ellipticity can vary with radius?
In that case it does, but this is a wrong case because this map has been smoothed. So in the inner part, what you get is actually the smoothing kernel, which is spherical, circular.
Okay. Sure, but the data must contain some constraint on how much.
Yeah, so when you
measure some effective one, but how much variation is
there? So there's no variation. So as soon as you get away from the really central part where you're dominated by the kernel, it's a plateau at 0.65 or 0.68. Whatever.
Here the question again, why do you need the kernel?
Because I didn't do that.
Oh, it's fourth author. How many stars were in Sloan and how many in LBT?
Since Sloan it was of the order of 200 or 150, and in the LBT it's a few thousand, I'd say. So I've tried applying the maximum likelihood on this one. Unfortunately, the half-life radius is roughly going down there. So there's a need. There's no good estimate of the background from this data. So you need to fiddle a little bit with the background estimate. Otherwise, the fit, given this covariance between the background level and the half-life radius, the fit tries to get a higher, larger half-life radius to compensate from background stars.
So is Hercules too far away to see any of those? Jorge, you had your sort of paracenter positions. Is Hercules just too far
away? Yeah, it's too far away.
So what was your answer to the question?
Okay. Before getting to the answer, so we talked yesterday about observational facts. So the observational fact is that the measured ellipticity is 0.68. But actually, it's not the true ellipticity of the system, probably, because it might be something like that that's projected on the sky. It might be something like that that's projected on the sky or something like that, whatever. So what I've been trying to do is actually to assume some orbit for the system and just say that the major axis is aligned with the orbit of the system. And we know the radial velocity that's been measured by Marla and Josh. And so the only thing that's going to change with the real ellipticity, the deprojected ellipticity of the system is just a function of the tangential motion that is put. Or that the system has, and there's no way to measure that from proper motions because the system is just too far away, and I don't believe proper motions anyway. But the thing is that the true ellipticity becomes then a function of the tangential velocity that we don't know and the radial velocity that we do know. Now, if Hercules has been shaped by tidal interaction, then the ellipticity needs, the orbit of Hercules needs to come close enough to the Milky Way that this tidal interaction happens. We actually have some constraints on that. Either you take a median constraint, which is that it comes within 20 kiloparsecs, the orbit has to come within 20 kiloparsecs of the Milky Way, or you take a conservative estimate that it has to, if it goes in these shaded regions, there's no tidal interaction, so you have to be in the white region here. Then since we know all the parameters of Hercules except for its proper motion, just simulating orbits with different proper motions, we end up with this line here. So Hercules orbits fall on this line. This is tangential velocity as a function of pericentric distance. So to have tidal interaction, in the best case scenario, basically it has to fall under that. So it has to be, the tangential motion has to be within plus or minus 60 kilometers per second, roughly. Whereas in the conservative estimate, it still has to be under about 100 kilometers per second to have Hercules come close enough to the Milky Way that it becomes tidally distorted. And so when you do that, then you can deproject the ellipticity, and this is the curve, the back curve that you have there. The true value, the observed value is here at 0.68. And the deprojection and the conservative estimate is this dark gray region. The ellipticity is at least 0.8. And with the other limit, it goes up to 0.9 or 0.80 something. So the deprojected ellipticity is probably more of the order of 0.8, which is the same one as the one observed for Ursa Major. And I have a very hard time believing that a system with an axis ratio of 10 to 1, basically, could be still bound. So if it's tidal interaction that's happening, Jorge told us yesterday that basically there shouldn't be any change in the ellipticity because the systems are highly dark matter dominated or whatever happens, until basically they become unbound. And when they become unbound, then the ellipticity goes through the roof because basically what we see is the part of the stream that's stretching out. So what I would tend to believe is that in a few cases, and I'm not saying all of these Earth's ultra-faint dwarfs are like that, but in a few cases, like Hercules, Ursa Major 1, what we actually see is just these disrupted, completely disrupting systems that become unbound and that are just populating the halo with their stars. And so if we assume that they lost maybe 90% of their stars, then it means that the progenitor of something like Hercules was a bit fainter than Draco. So there's no real problem with the mass middle-listy or luminosity-middle-listy relation, because these systems originally weren't too bright anyway.
But do these guys show those same nice flat velocity dispersion profiles, or is it?
We don't know, because there's just like 20 or 40 stars in them, so there's no velocity dispersion profile.
So there's no
profile. There's just a velocity dispersion. Not for these. The 3,000 are for the bright systems.
The 20 or 40, that's just the ones that have been measured have radial velocities. Is that what
they're
you're
the
saying?
Ones really that are bright enough with current technology.
Right. Okay.
I thought we were talking about Hercules.
Yeah, so Hercules has, you'd have to ask Mala, but I think they have 20 or 40 radial velocities in the system. And the other problem is that all their radial velocities are roughly in this part here, whereas you would want to have it along the major axis, have a better handle of that.
What's the column magnitude diagram?
It's like Buddhas. It's like Buddhas, the one that I showed at the beginning.
It's 100 kiloparsecs?
145.
Is there any possibility that you're percolating noise? In other words, you happen to find these regions where you confuse the stars that you're fitting isoplets to with noise, and then in which case you would tend to not percolate noise circular symmetrically, but off in different directions. Then you get everything to be elongated.
It's just fitting.
Well, no, what I meant, is it possible that for some reason, that the tails of the distribution at low stellar surface brightness are actually background? But really, with the real galaxy, is this thing in the middle?
No. I mean, as I was saying, you don't look at the first few contours because they're dominated by a smoothing kernel. But as you go away, the ellipticity remains exactly the same as you go away.
Sort of looks that way, but yeah. Kind of hard to tell.
And as Andy was saying, what I've been doing is maximum likelihood, so it's not biased and beautiful.
You know, can you find how big is this field? It's just an LBT field?
So that's 20-25 arc minutes.
And that's all that's been done, so you can't see beyond it.
So I have some observations coming up going like there and down there.
LBT?
With the VMOS on the VMOS using imaging mode on the VLT.
What is the expectation for extra tidal stars, tidally stripped stars?
So Jorge was saying, unfortunately, that if you believe his models, that the break that he talked about yesterday is actually like over there. And so this is where you have extra tidal stars, and I would expect basically zero stars over there, or one out of the whole sky. But so if what I'm saying is right, and it might be completely wrong, if what I'm saying is right, actually, as Martin mentioned, since the system is unbound, then there's a shear over the whole system. So it's just a matter of measuring real velocities along the major axis. And if there's a continuous gradient, then you would expect that from an unbound system, and you wouldn't expect that from a bound system.
So you're going to take your VMOS data to identify candidates for real velocities?
No, I'm actually going to put in a VLT proposal and Flames proposal in a week to try to do that.
OK.
So what's the gradient going to be?
I haven't checked yet, but I should check by the end of the week, since I have to write this proposal. And there's Mala also has some upcoming DMOS time to just go and hit it. Well, hit this one and the other one. So it's going to be
obvious. Is there any value in using these type of things, like it's been done with Sagittarius with SIM to measure the shape of the halo? Is it big enough?
No.
So for Sagittarius, what you need is actually the stream. It's not the galaxy.
Right. So you also have a stream here.
But you.
Not
yeah, I mean, you have one degree of the stream, or half a degree of the stream. You need the whole stream to sample the whole sky.
To have some estimate of the
sample the whole sky. But anyway, is there any information you can get out of this? How many giants do you have along here that could actually be done? How many giants are this?
Two targets
Brighter than 19.
probably 20 to 40.
But all concentrated in the center?
Yeah, most. Well, there might be a few away, but you need spectroscopy to really isolate them from the background there.
So suppose the thing were projected the way you say, in other words, a high opticity. That would suggest that there is, you do have some leverage on, potentially have some leverage on asking that question with your data, because you would get a different distribution of giants along the RGB than you might expect for a standard mass function population.
You mean because there's a depth in the system?
Right.
The problem is that this guy is sitting at 140 kiloparsecs. So if you have a change in from the right side to the left side of, you know, 1 or 2 kiloparsecs, which is what we're talking about here, you're never going to see it. That's 1% of the distance. So you're never going to see it as a change in magnitude.
Well, they'll move the giants up and down the branch. My question is, are the giants actually, do they appear to be more spread out than they should be?
Not necessarily.
If
you look at the place to do that is to look at the horizontal branch stars, and there are about 8 horizontal branch stars in the system, and they align quite well in the horizontal branch.
Quite well just means 10% or something.
Yeah, I mean they align as you would expect for a single population system, because
1%.
Exactly, that's what I mean. Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, that's.
You know, if they're all like this, it's kind of weird. Why are we seeing?
No, I'm not saying they're all. No. I'm not.
This is the one we know about, so let's jump to conclusions.
I'm not saying they're all like this. I'm saying that maybe a few of them are like this.
I'm not saying you're saying. I'm saying suppose they're all like this. It's pretty weird.
So they're easier to pick out, presumably, if they're pointing at us because they're higher surface brightness.
It could be a selection
effect. So Ursa Major 1, which is the highest elasticity system, actually has almost no radial velocity, so it's probably seen. There's no need to deproject it, basically.
Well, I mean, if this distribution was independent of the luminosity for the brightest ones, you would still find that. I mean, you would still find the elliptical ones there.
But maybe a pure selection effect. In other words, the galaxy really is a round little teensy weensy ball. And these tails that are coming off, the big round blob in the middle, actually the part that is the string, and we happen to be lining up along it. And then we don't have any more ellipticity conundrum.
Then we have
dark.
A really weird, why are the stars so concentrated?
Because that's really a galaxy. That's what was left of this disrupting thing.
But then you would see a bump in the profile at the very center. That we don't see.
Can you tell?
Well, if you have 50% of the stars just within 1 arcsecond.
Remember, you're lined up. I mean, the only way that you're seeing these very large ellipticities, assuming that's the, is that you're lined up so that you've got one tail coming up that direction, one tail's coming up here, blob is in the middle. There'd be confusion, foreground and background, but there'd still be a blob in there. It would be different if you're seeing it, you know, face on, so there's a tail,
yeah.
We're looking down the tails, then it might actually be hard to discriminate.
I guess that's true. You don't see the break in the profile, right? As it gets more and more lined up, it's hard.
But I think it's further down the road from what Jorge showed. Mm-hmm. It's really disrupted. So the one thing I haven't looked at yet is what, if you disrupt a galaxy, so basically take Jorge's model and then go on and integrate it longer. Or with a different orbit, a more radial orbit, then what happens and how long do you observe something that looks still like a blob and not just a stream without any concentration? I mean, we know, just looking at simulations, you know that it happens for some time, but how long does it happen and so on?
I've seen that. We'll have to see this carefully, but I've seen only this kind of configuration when you have. That the system is totally disrupted, and for some fraction of the orbital period, what you see is that like a tube of stars, which is not bound anymore, but they still keep the configuration in phase space for a while. But I've seen that only when I use mass flow slide models, you know, core models. When I use these Caspi halos, what I got is that all this mass tripping occurs only after the very center, and the system seems to be bound, you know. Eternity, basically.
So why don't we find them?
As far as I can reach with my.
Why don't we find streams without obvious progenitors?
Well, Because as I saw, as I showed yesterday, what happens when you strip these systems, you go down the luminosity, you know, luminosity and the surface brightness at the same time. So basically, if you continue that process for a long time, they would get invisible, and they would be far away, not close to the epicenter most of them. So I don't know. It seems to be unlikely to detect them once they are having heavily stripped the stars. But, yeah, as I said, we'll have to take a look at close. Mm-hmm.
That's what I had to say.